He replaced the radio. "Mr. Monckton," he said, bringing out several photographs of the worm. "We're looking for these. Any spaces where they might be hiding have to be opened and searched." Monckton took the photos, flipped through them, and passed them around.
"Yes, sir. We're at your service."
"You and your team know the ins and outs of this area. We'd like to start at the far end and sweep back to this point. It seems most efficient if your crew were to take the lead, opening every possible space where these things might be hiding."
"Yes, sir."
Monckton gestured to his men to follow him, and they filed to the back of the engine room via a narrow alleyway among pipes and the throbbing engines. "Most of what you see here," Monckton said, "the engines, the piping, those generators, those can't be opened. Or rather, opening them up would mean stopping the ship and shutting off power. But they're totally sealed environments, so I don't think the worms could get in, and they'd prove a very hostile environment anyway. Most of these pipes are carrying fuel and coolant under high pressure, the engines running at 160 degrees.
"Understood," said Garza. "We won't deal with those now. Maybe later, if necessary."
They reached the rear wall, a riveted bulkhead of painted steel.
"Chief, let's start with that row of control panels," Garza said. "We'll need to take off the covers and search each one."
"Very well, sir."
One of the junior engineers swiftly produced a large toolbox, and they unscrewed the first panel and set it aside, exposing a close packing of wires and circuit boards. Monckton's engineers stepped aside as Garza's team came forward. They pulled on heavy leather gloves and face shields borrowed from the ship's metal shop. Garza watched closely as they poked around, sorting through various bundles of wires, pulling them aside, making sure all of them were real. They followed this up with dental mirrors and pencil lights to peer into the nooks and crannies.
"It's clean," Garza said.
"Next."
There was an entire series of panels, switches, and control consoles. They went through them methodically. All were clean.
"Let's move on to the ductwork," Garza said, glancing up.
This was going to be a bitch.
"Where do those ducts go?"
"They're for engine air and ventilation. The engine air ducts go straight up to the deck. The ventilation ducts are supply and return from HVAC. You want to examine them?"
"You bet we do. Let's start up there, with that square ductwork on the ceiling."
The upper ductwork was accessible via a narrow ladder leading to a precarious catwalk. It consisted of a single large, square duct running the length of the engine room, spaced with oval, swinging gaskets that emitted air when ventilation was needed, but swung shut when off. It ended with a large T with an axial fan.
"Stick the video cam into each of those openings," said Garza. "Let's take a look."
Vinter and another security officer climbed the ladder, the second carrying a small camera and a light on a telescoping pole. Vinter pushed open the first gasket with a gloved hand, while the other eased the camera in. A video image appeared on the iPad Garza was carrying, transmitted via Bluetooth. The duct was empty, at least as far as the light could reach.
"Next vent."
The men moved down the catwalk and repeated the procedure, looking into each vent in turn.
Nothing.
They continued to the end of the duct, where it connected to a large, horizontal T-fitting. An access opening was fixed into the underside of the duct, on hinges, but screwed shut. The axial fan was humming at the vent's terminus. Below them, the ship's main engine throbbed, the heat rising from it in waves.
"Can we switch that fan off?" Garza asked.
"No problem."
The fan was turned off.
"Okay. Swing the vent open and stick the camera in there."
The catwalk was tight, forcing Vinter, in the lead, to crouch underneath the ductwork in order to unscrew the vent door above his head. Two screws came out, which he tucked in his mouth, and then he reached up, grasped the vent flange, and wiggled it from side to side, loosening it from the grip of age. It opened with a screech of dirty hinges. A thin shower of soot came out, sprinkling his head and shoulders. Vinter wiped away the soot with his gloved hand. The man behind him, carrying the camera on a stick, knelt and positioned himself underneath as well, easing the camera through the opening. For a split second, Garza was bewildered at what he saw pop into life on his screen. A tangled, gray, writhing mass.
"Worms!" he cried. Get back!
It happened instantly. A sudden burst of scrabbling inside the galvanized ductwork, and then a mass of wriggling, squealing worms came spilling out of the open vent, falling onto the heads and shoulders of the two security officers. They screamed, flailing and twisting, frantically trying to slap and brush the things off them. In the process, they fell against the thin railing of the catwalk, and it gave way, sending them crashing to the engine room floor, the worms raining down along with them and skittering in every direction. Garza leapt back, horrified. He could see several worms already squirming into the clothing and wriggling underneath the face protectors of the men on the floor, who were trying to beat them off in a panic. Vinter had torn off his face protector to pluck away the worms underneath, but even more worms converged, and his face grew obscured by a solid, writhing mass trying to get at his nose.
Son of a bitch!
Garza yanked a small hatchet out of his sheath on his belt and began chopping at the worms on the floor, trying to crawl toward the struggling men. The remaining two men of his team pulled out their weapons, a crowbar and a heavy wrench, and began beating at the worms. They came fast, making a keening, whining noise like wounded rats.
Fall back! There's too many!
Garza shouted, but nobody needed urging. Every man was already retreating in the face of the onslaught. Garza scrambled back himself, chopping at worms left and right as they wriggled toward him. This was clearly a fight they were not going to win.
Get the hell out of here, he cried. Seal the engine room door!
He retreated with the engineers, the firemen, and the two security officers single file, chopping and beating back the worms, which slashed and struck at them like maddened snakes. Monckton, the chief, grabbed a fire extinguisher and blasted the worms, to no visible effect. As they retreated, Garza could tell that Vinter and the other security officer were already in bad shape, apparently unconscious, twitching worms hanging out of their nostrils. A junior engineer lay on the floor as well, covered with worms, screaming and rolling around, trying to pull worms off his clothing. It was too late. Several slipped into his nose despite all he could do, and in a moment he went still, as if suddenly asleep. Even as they retreated, more worms were dropping out of the ductwork above their heads, falling down on them. They reached the door, and Garza stood his ground, smashing at the worms as the others got out. Then he stepped back, and the chief slammed the bulkhead door and dogged it down. Several worms, cut in half in the doorway, wriggled about in pieces before Garza beat them to a pulp.
Christ,
Monckton said, as the others searched their clothing frantically.
We're clean, said Garza after a moment.
God, those poor guys.
We can't leave them in there, said Monckton.
They're already done for.
A trembling silence fell on the group.
What about the engine room fire suppression system? Garza asked. Can we set that off? Kill the worms that way?
The system uses FM-200, said the fireman. Non-toxic.
Okay, so how do we seal the engine room? Is there another door?
Monckton shook his head.
These bulkhead doors are all watertight, but the air ducts go straight up to the deck. We can't seal them.
Why the hell not?
Without engine air, the ship would be dead in the water. No propulsion, no electrical power. And the ventilation ducts go everywhere to and from HVAC. They reach into every corner of the vessel.
Garza shook his head. He wiped his face again.
Monckton, can you get me diagrams of all the ductwork on the ship?
The digital schematics are all loaded into the ship's network.
Garza nodded.
They're apparently breeding in that ductwork. There are many, many more worms just in that one space than we brought aboard with the specimen. This is our new priority. I'll be redeploying all sweep teams to clean out the ductwork, pinpoint their breeding source. And Chief Monckton, you're going to mastermind the operation for me.
Chapter 55. In the mission control room, Glynn replayed, yet again, the nuclear simulation as the others watched in silence. It was as if he was looking for something they had missed. But Gideon knew that nothing had been missed. The explosion would simply not reach the deeply buried seeds, no matter what parameters they changed. Glynn shut down the monitor, pushed the keyboard away.
There was a long silence. Gideon glanced at MacFarlane, but his face was dark and inscrutable.
All right, said Glynn. We'll fire the nuke anyway and pray it works.
At this, MacFarlane issued a low, dark laugh.
Pray, he said. Is that where we're at? What other choice do we have? We're out of time.
He turned. Gideon, arm the nuke.
You can't do that, MacFarlane said. You're so eaten up with guilt about how you delayed acting on the Rolvag that now you're making the opposite mistake, rushing headlong into a foolish, useless action.
Glynn ignored this.
Gideon, arm the nuke and load it on the ROV. I'll give you all the personnel you need to get this done as fast as possible.
Gideon once again saw the gleam in Glynn's normally unexpressive eyes. The man had a point. The nuke was their only option. It was only a matter of time until either they were all infected, or the chain of command aboard ship broke down completely. It could work. It would probably destroy the alien brain at the very least, and they had no solid evidence that all the brains had to be destroyed in order to kill the entity.
This is just what Lloyd warned about, MacFarlane said. You're too close to this. Your judgment is clouded. You're going to doom us all.
What other options do we have? Unless we act, unless we detonate that bomb, the entire world is doomed. Glynn turned back to Gideon. Arm the bomb. Gideon took a ragged breath.
No, he said after a moment. No, MacFarlane's right. We only have one shot at this. We can't just detonate and hope for the best, not unless we're sure it's going to work. There must be another way.
If you won't arm it, I will.
Glynn got up to leave.
Wait!
Gideon glanced over. MacFarlane had grasped Glynn's arm. The meteorite hunter's face was hollow and dark and beaded in sweat.
I have an idea, he said.
I'm listening, Glynn said.
Years ago, I explored Aklavik, an unusual meteorite crater in northern Canada, one in which a very small impactor resulted in a gigantic crater. I wondered, how did this small rock gouge such a large hole?
Go on.
So I consulted several physicists. The meteorite hit a glacier. It appears the strike caused a phenomenon known as a liquid-liquid explosion.
I've never heard of such a thing, said Glynn, dubiously.
It's rare. What happens is two liquids, one cold and one super hot, are violently mixed together. That in turn creates a huge surface area for immediate heat transfer, and one of the liquids undergoes instantaneous explosive boiling. It's a big problem in steel mills, for example, if molten steel breaks out and flows over wet concrete.
I ought to know. I worked in just such a mill for a while, 3 years back.
So how did that work with a meteorite and ice? Asked Glynn. Both are solids.
The nickel iron meteorite liquefied from the shock of impact. That's common. The ice also liquefied from the shockwave. The two mingled violently, and a vast quantity of water boiled in a millisecond, causing a massive explosion.
You think that will happen with our nuke? Gideon asked. In the deep ocean?
No, the water won't do it. You need a second liquid, a very hot one, to mix with it.
Such as?
Metal. Steel. You'd need a large amount of molten metal to mix with the water.
So we put the bomb in a metal shell?
That's not nearly enough, said MacFarlane. You want as much metal as possible, tons and tons of it.
We can't wrap tons of metal around the bomb, said Gideon. We wouldn't be able to deliver it.
You don't have to wrap the bomb. You could lay sheets of metal on the sea floor, lay them flat. You do it above where those seeds are growing, that'll focus the explosion.
Sheets of metal?
There must be huge amounts of steel plating on this ship. We could cut a bunch of bulkheads out, stack the sheets of steel on the bottom, then detonate the nuke above them. Close enough for the shockwave to liquefy the steel.
How much steel are you talking about? Asked Glynn.
I'd guess a couple hundred tons at least. The more the better.
A silence.
How do you propose to stack hundreds of tons of steel 2 miles down?
Lower the plates on cables,
We have two deepwater cables and one winch, said Glynn. The cables are for emergency lifting of a DRV and are rated to no more than 2,500 pounds displacement mass. It would take hours to lower each plate. Even if we could remove sufficient plating from the ship, we'd never get that much metal down there in time. And will the creature just sit still, doing nothing while we stack iron around it?
We could dump the metal sheets overboard, said McFarlane.
Those sheets would orient themselves as they sank, Glynn said. They would end up being driven into the mud vertically. Would that work?
No, said McFarlane.
Brilliant idea, Glynn said. A shame it isn't feasible. Again he turned to leave.
Gideon stopped him.
Perhaps this is insane, but isn't there already a huge amount of metal lying down there?
Glynn frowned impatiently.
Where?
The Rolvag, of course.
Chapter 56. Greg Masterson felt like he was losing control of the mess hall. Someone had brought out a couple of bottles of scotch, from God knew where, and they were being passed around. Voices were raised, people were talking over each other, and nothing was being accomplished aside from useless venting. This was really pissing him off. In frustration, he climbed up on one of the cafeteria tables.
Hey, listen up!
The roar of discontent went on.
God damn it, listen to me!
He stomped loudly on the table.
Shut the hell up!
That worked. The room quieted down.
We need a plan, and I've got one.
Masterson let the anticipation build. There were about 20 people there. Crew, mostly, with a few members of the scientific staff. That should be enough. And they looked motivated. Very motivated.
Are you ready to listen?
He deliberately pitched his voice low, soft, and this worked even better, as the room finally fell silent.
Someone shut and locked the door.
It was done.
Okay, Masterson said. I think we all know the mission has failed.
A strong murmur of agreement.
The ship is crawling with those damned alien worms. And they're multiplying.
Rumor has it, they're in the ductwork.
They're in the engine room. They're everywhere.
He paused.
We need to get the hell off this ship. As soon as possible.
A chorus of agreement. Masterson could feel the energy in the room. People were really listening, and now they were coming together. He saw a whiskey bottle pass from hand to hand.
Hey, put the bottle down, for Christ's sakes. We need to keep our wits about us. It's bad enough that we're all amped up on speed.
It was sheepishly put down.
God knows how many of our crewmates have been infected. And remember, there's no way to tell. No way to tell. Not until it's too late.
Agreement all around.
Okay. The closest mainland port is Ushuaia, in Argentina. It's 700 nautical miles northwest of here. If we start now, at full speed, we'll get there in 58 hours.
A chorus of agreement.
Up there in Mission Control, they're going on as if nothing had changed. They still think they can kill that monster. They're delusional.
Or maybe they're infected,
someone cried.
That's also a possibility, Masterson agreed. As I said, there's no way to know. All I do know is in 58 hours, we could be off this ship and safe in Ushuaia.
This observation was greeted with a roar of approval.
What do we do then? Simple. We take over.
He looked around fiercely.
In this room, we have the expertise needed. Engineering, navigational, operational. And we have the manpower. We can do this.
Another dramatic pause.
We can do this!
Echoed through the restive crowd. He also heard the word mutiny sprinkled here and there.
Yes, he said quietly. Mutiny. But a necessary mutiny. A mutiny to save not only our own lives, but the lives of every other uninfected person on board.
This suggestion silenced the room. You could hear a pin drop.
Are you with me?
Masterson asked quietly. A low murmur of agreement gathered steam.
It's now or never. Stand up if you're with me.
One stood up, another, and then another. And within a moment, they all rose, with a loud scraping of chairs and a swell of voices.
Is there anyone who disagrees?
No one did. And this only served to reinforce Masterson's belief that they needed to carry off this mutiny as soon as possible. Right now, in fact.
Chapter 57. Garza crawled along the horizontal supply air duct that ran the length of the ship, with his two remaining men ahead of him, Monckton behind. They were all wearing construction helmets, equipped with powerful headlamps. It was noisy and dirty, but there was, at least, a flow of fresh air. They were approaching the engine room, but so far had seen no sign of worms. He had in hand an improvised weapon, an electric zapper. They all had them. Monckton had had the idea, and he'd assembled them quickly, using flashlight shells, a spark circuit and spark gap, and a capacitor, the whole thing powered by a pair of D batteries. Monckton was turning out to be some kind of genius. The chief engineer had taken a piece of worm, found it conducted electricity like mad, and decided they must be highly vulnerable to surges in voltage. In about 15 minutes, he assembled all the necessary zappers, and now they were on their way to the engine room to see if they could find where the worms were breeding. So far, they'd found and zapped a couple of worms, and the zappers had worked beautifully. The zapped worms were dead, or at least so they seemed, all withered and contracted into little gray knots. Using his radio, he'd ordered Betances, the chief of security, to deploy his own teams into the ductwork in the other areas of the ship. If they didn't locate the breeding source of the worm soon, they'd be overwhelmed, and fast. Now they came to an X-junction. Garza consulted the HVAC diagram on his tablet, and noted they were just a few bends away from the engine room duct. The two men in front of him used cameras on selfie sticks to peer around the corners, but saw nothing. The crawling went on forever. They had to pause at every junction, every gasket, and inspect for worms. Garza believed that the worms might be like denning rattlesnakes, seeking each other out and gathering in one mass for mating. He believed that could very well be taking place in the ducts above the engine room, because of the heat. If he was right, if they were all assembled in a single nest, maybe they could take them all out at one go. Take the left duct, he said, and they crawled on. They were almost there. Patrick Bramble awoke, feeling terrifically refreshed, although his body ached from lying on the floor. How had he gotten on the floor? He recalled going to sleep in the chair. As he sat up, he saw that Sax was sleeping in another chair, her feet propped up on the lab table, still set up for the blood tests. Her face was smooth and peaceful, her lips a little wet, her glossy hair spilling across her neck.
Dr. Sax?
She opened her eyes, then sat up.
Oops, sorry. I didn't mean to be sleeping.
She glanced at her phone. Not for that long, anyway. The cell phone alarm was supposed to go off. Bramble picked his phone off the countertop.
Looks like we slept through the alarm. Well, we certainly needed it,
he chuckled with a twinkle in his eye.
Haven't we been naughty, sleeping like this? Better not tell anyone.
I feel so much better. I was just about dead. I feel like a new woman.
Me too. New man, I mean.
Sax laughed lightly. She stretched, stood up, and looked over the setup on the table.
Do you really think you can come up with a blood test for that thing?
Bramble sighed.
I doubt it. It seemed worth a try, but you know, on further reflection, it's pretty far-fetched.
It was crazy, really, to think a simple blood test would somehow reveal an infection from an alien parasite.
There must be better ways to spend our time, said Sax.
Bramble cast his mind back to the problem. What they desperately needed, he realized, was more information about the creature. That was the real problem. Their ignorance of the baobab, what it was, how it thought, why it was here. He felt extremely curious about it. It had come such a vast, lonely distance, and its life cycle was proving to be as complex as anything on Earth, even more so.
"We're spinning our wheels in this lab," Sax said. "This isn't getting us anywhere."
"No, indeed.
I wish there was a way for us to be more useful."
Bramble fell back into musing.
"The problem," he said slowly, "is that the wrong people have been sent down to observe the baobab. Gideon Crewe, a nuclear engineer. Lispinard, a marine biologist. Garza, another engineer."
Sax nodded.
"That's a good point."
"Technocrats, all. None of them are humanists. Not like you and me."
Sax nodded, running a hand over her glossy brown hair, smoothing it down. Bramble found himself admiring just how healthy it looked, and how delicate and white her hand was. He wondered why he hadn't paid more attention to her before.
"What they really should have done," Bramble said, "is to send someone like you or me down there. You with an M.D. and Ph.D. in medical science, or me with an M.D. and decades of experience. We're the ones best suited for understanding an alien organism like that."
I couldn't agree more. Bramble fell into another musing silence, thinking. His mind seemed unusually clear. It was remarkable, really, what a good nap could do. As he went back over in his mind the progress of the expedition so far, it really did appear to him now to have been a dog's breakfast from the very beginning. Everything had been done the wrong way. The whole concept of killing the creature was flawed. It was clearly intelligent, and as such, it could be communicated with, reasoned with, understood. Prothero had started down that path, but there had been no concerted effort, not really. If the baobab could learn whale speech, surely it could learn human speech.
"You know," said Bramble, turning to Sax, "I think one of us should go down there and try to communicate with that thing. That would solve all our problems in one fell swoop."
He found Sax looking back at him with admiration in her eyes. He hadn't noticed before how pretty she was. "Dr. Bramble, that is truly insightful," she hesitated. "But how would we get down there?"
"We'll simply borrow a DSV. I believe John is right there in the hangar, ready to go. I truly feel that a simple conversation, a respectful meeting of the minds, would solve all our problems."
"We just take it?"
"Yes," said Bramble. "We take it. Only one of us can go, of course, and that one will be me."
"I should be the one to go," she said. "After all, I've had some experience piloting DSVs."
"I'm not sure," Bramble said.
"Oh, please do let me go. You'll be with me every step of the way, in spirit."
Bramble thought about this. Then he nodded.
"Very well. Since we'll be launching the DSV without any help, I suppose it might take my strength to manhandle the necessary equipment alone."
"Thank you, thank you," Sax said, her eyes shining.
"Dr. Sax, I don't believe we should waste any more time.
Do you?"
"Dr. Bramble," she said, clasping her hands together, "I so admire your wisdom and courage."
Chapter 58. As Garza and his team neared the engine room, he could feel and hear the vibration of the turbines coming through the ventilation duct. The focused beams of their headlamps cast a strong light down the duct to where it ended in a T. Beyond that T, and to the right, was the engine room duct. That was where they had initially encountered the nest of worms. He felt fairly confident there were more. He tapped the foot of the guy in front and used hand signals to indicate they were to move up to the T and then pause. It was impossible to crawl through the ducts without generating a lot of noise and vibration, but Garza hoped that the worms would not be alerted, since plenty of noise and vibration was already traveling through the ductwork of the ship. The ducts were of sturdy, galvanized steel, and well attached, but even so, they were not designed to carry the weight of four people, and as they moved, the metal groaned in protest, swayed occasionally, even sagged a little.
They had to spread out to try to distribute the weight, but it still felt at times that the ductwork might just come loose and precipitate them to the floor of whatever room they were in. As they neared the junction, Garza signaled another halt. He listened, straining to hear any screeching movements of shifting worms or the chalk on blackboard squealing sounds they made when excited. But there was nothing, just the humming of the engines and the whisper of moving air. If there was a mass of them around the corner, there would be no running away. All four of them knew that. On their hands and knees in a confined space, with no possibility of turning around, they would have to stand their ground, stay and fight like the defenders of Thermopylae. The point man edged up to the tee and, holding his camera out on its stick, eased it past the corner. The image appeared on Garza's tablet. It took a moment to wrap his mind around it. The duct was free and clear for perhaps 20 feet, but then it became totally blocked by a large, bubbling mass that looked like thick, gluey porridge, or perhaps a giant glistening fungus. The surface of the mass was covered with what appeared to be giant pustules, but as he watched, a pustule burst, and from it dropped a worm, which crawled off. And then another pustule burst. Another worm dropped out. So the worms were breeding, but not at all in the way he'd assumed. It was a single entity pumping out eggs. Fine. That made it all the more vulnerable. In silence, he passed the tablet around so everyone could see what lay ahead, and then gestured for them to move back a little. When they had done so, he whispered, "That mass is right above the main engine, probably attracted to the heat." Nods. "We can't get into the engine room, so we have to attack it from here, inside the duct." "How?" asked one of his men. Moncton, who was behind Garza, whispered, "We tase it." He held up his electrical prod. "I can set these to shock on contact, like a taser. We throw them at the breeding mass." "The current from a couple of D batteries isn't going to kill it," one of Garza's men said. "The circuitry in here produces low current, but high voltage," Moncton said in a low voice. 9,000 volts, to be exact. "So yes, it might kill it. It will kill it. That life form conducts electricity better than copper." "We're dead meat crammed into this ductwork. We can't even turn around."
"Pass me your zappers," Garza said. "I'll do it. I'll toss two, keep one in reserve. Moncton, you take charge of the fourth zapper. Meanwhile, the three of you get back, and be ready to haul ass."
There was just enough room at the T-junction for Garza to squeeze past the two forward men. Moncton quickly unscrewed each device, tinkered with it, screwed it back together. "Just turn the flashlight switch on," he said, handing three of them up to Garza. "Then the current will flow between the prongs as soon as there's a connection, which there will be the moment these prongs make contact with that thing. Okay?"
"Okay."
Garza began to crawl forward, past the T-junction and to the right. His headlamp illuminated the pulsing mass. The worms were very responsive to light, and the bloated mass also reacted. The pulsing suddenly stopped. The worms crawling around it froze, coiled up, and took a protective, striking position. Garza braced himself, switched on the first zapper, and tossed it as easily as a horseshoe. It was a good throw, and its two prongs struck the mass squarely. There was a flash of electricity, and the thing contracted violently, with a flabby rush of air, most of its pustules bursting and releasing worms in various stages of development. There was a moment of stasis, and then worms surrounding the thing came whipping down the duct toward him, keening and scrabbling, their black teeth poking out. He tossed the second zapper and made another direct hit, with its attendant flash of electricity. At this, the thing ruptured open, expelling a foul, jelly-like mass of half-formed worms. Garza crawled backward as fast as he could go, but the worms coming at him were faster. As they caught up to him, he zapped them with a third prod. As he did so, the worms would make a little screech, then contract into grotesque, pretzel-like shapes.
"Get going!" he shouted. "Retreat to the nearest opening!"
A worm reached him, slashed at him. Garza zapped it, then zapped another. One after the other, after the other. But his zapper's recovery time was slowing. The battery would soon be dead.
Give me the other one.
Monkton handed Garza the last prod.
There's a big vent here,
a voice called from behind.
Exit!
The men dropped out of the vent, Garza last, followed by a river of worms.
Forget the worms, he shouted. Run!
They had come out into the corridor beyond the engine room, and they all immediately took off, ducking beneath a bulkhead door. Garza slammed and dogged it behind them.
Jesus H. Christ,
he said, leaning against the door and gasping for breath. He had cuts all over his hands from the slashing worms.
You think there are more of those breeders? Monkton asked.
The way our luck is going, I sure as hell do, Garza replied, pulling out his radio to call Betances. And at the rate those worms are being pumped out, I'll lay you 10-1. We're all zombies by lunchtime.
Chapter 59 Patrick Bramble and Antonella Sachs emerged onto the hangar deck shortly after the sun rose over the rim of the ocean.
What remarkable weather we've been having, said Bramble cheerfully as they strolled across the hangar.
Nice of that approaching storm to hold off long enough for us to accomplish our goal.
Really remarkable.
The DSV John sat in its rolling cradle, strapped down and draped in canvas. No one was around. The ship was in an uproar, and all security personnel had been pulled off to assist in the hunt for worms.
Are you sure you know how to operate this thing? Asked Bramble.
Part of Glynn's habit of double overage, you know. Safety and redundancy. Really, it's rather like playing a video game. Joystick controlled. Pretty simple. Although, in this instance, I'll have to disable the autopilot AI and turn off the surface override. Otherwise, the do-gooders might try to pull me back up and stop our mission.
You can do that?
I was in mission control when they forced Gideon Crew's DSV back to the surface. Back when Alex Lispinard went to her new home. I saw them open the procedures manual on how to override the AI and the DSV operator's control. I saw the codes. She shook her head. If they hadn't meddled so unnecessarily like that, maybe Dr. Crew could have come home then, too. Once again, Bramble considered how profoundly misconceived the entire mission was. An intelligent alien life form had come to Earth. And what was mankind's first response? Kill it. How sad. And yet, how predictable.
All right, let's take a look at this, he said.
They each gripped an edge of the tarp and slid it off, exposing the mini-sub. It looked fresh and new, gleaming in the sodium lights of the hangar, ready for its next dive, iron ballast already attached. Sachs walked around, unclipping the tie-downs that held it in place on the cradle. She climbed into the motorized cart used to haul the DSVs to and fro, backed it up, and attached it to the towing pin. Open the hangar doors, she said. Bramble rolled back the double doors, the sunlight pouring in. What a beautiful day it was, he thought, as he looked out to the distant sea horizon. A beautiful day in which to open a channel of communication, real communication, with the life form. It had tried to speak to them in blue whale speech. If it could learn that, it could surely learn English. Indeed, with all the chatter it must have been picking up, chances were it already knew some English. He breathed deeply, thinking about the momentous step they were about to take. Not for themselves, but for all humankind. He stood in the warm spring sun and watched Sachs expertly tow John into position under the A-frame crane. Get out. Unhook it. She waved him over.
What are you doing? She asked.
Daydreaming. About being part of a day that will go down in history.
She laughed and gave him a playful punch on the arm. Come on. We've got work to do. Help me roll that ladder into position. They took the rolling ladder and together wheeled it over to the DSV. Bramble held the ladder in place, then watched her derriere as she climbed up and attached the crane's two cables to hooks on the DSV. Then she came back down. What are you grinning about?
You.
She smirked. I'm getting inside. Do you see that console over there? Those are the controls for the crane. Once again, joystick operated. You know how to use a joystick?
Oh dear, said Bramble. Never in my life.
She took his hand. I'll show you. It's easy. Just try not to bump me around too much before putting me in the water. At the console, she demonstrated up, down, sideways for the boom, plus the control to raise and lower the cables. And finally, the button that unhooked the DSV. Don't hit that button until I'm in the water, floating, with the cables slack.
Understood. Ready?
I'm ready. Bramble helped her onto the ladder and watched her climb up to the hatch at the top. The DSV really did look like the Yellow Submarine. Bramble had always felt a special affiliation with the Beatles, on account of his grandfather, the actor Wilfred Bramble, having played Paul McCartney's fictional grandfather in the film A Hard Day's Night. Okay, Patrick, she waved to him and gave him a thumbs up. He smiled and waved back, and then she descended and shut the hatch. Bramble looked around to see if anyone was paying attention. There was a knot of people at one end of the aft deck, talking or arguing, but they paid him no heed. His mind was unusually clear, and he remembered the directions perfectly. He maneuvered the joystick. The cables tightened, raising the sub from its cradle. When it was clear of the cradle, he pushed the crane stick sideways, and the crane obediently swung away from the A-frame, carrying the DSV until it was dangling over the stern. Checking to make sure there was plenty of clearance, he lowered John to the water, where it settled in, still buoyant. He pressed the button that disengaged the hooks, and the DSV was free.
Good luck, Antonella, he said to himself under his breath,
as a rush of air bubbles around the DSV indicated Sachs was filling ballast tanks. The mini-sub sank beneath the surface. He watched for a few minutes as it went down and then disappeared. Bramble felt a certain loneliness steal over him. He had to admit he was a bit in love with Sachs, but he would see her again, and soon. He was certain of that. Leaving the console, he wandered back into the hangar, feeling restless and anxious. He wondered what there was to do now. It did seem as if there should be more to do, and then it occurred to him what it was. Stop this insane use of the nuke. He wasn't sure when that was supposed to be deployed exactly, but it didn't matter. He could stop that right now. At the far end of the hangar, set apart from everything else, was another draped submersible. It was not a manned DSV, but a smaller ROV. That, he knew, was the intended delivery vehicle for the bomb. It would be a simple matter to make sure the ROV never delivered a bomb anywhere. Antonella Sachs worked the controls of John as it descended into the depths. She located the main panel, then punched in the code to deactivate the mini-sub's AI and disable any surface override of her autopilot. She felt a sensation of warmth and security as the DSV was enveloped in darkness. She could almost feel the massive weight of water pressing in on it relentlessly, increasing with every meter she sank. There was a feeling of anticipation, of excitement, as she was about to perform perhaps the greatest mission ever conducted by a human being. As she descended, humming a little tune to herself, she saw movement. A head poked out of a gap in the electronics, a small head with two beady eyes and a tiny puckered mouth. The mouth opened, exposing a single tooth. "Who are you?" Sachs asked playfully. As if in response, the little creature crawled out of its hiding place and came over, curling up against her thigh for warmth. She touched it. "There's a good boy," she said, stroking it as it relaxed in contentment. "There's a good boy." Chapter 60. Greg Masterson had gathered the mutineers in the rec room, adjacent to the staff quarters, to explain the plan of attack. They had arrived well-equipped with weapons. Many had knives, but some of the ex-servicemen had their sidearms as well. At the last minute, The group had been joined by two of the security guards who had been sweeping for worms, including the deputy security chief, a man named Vinter. Vinter was a godsend. He not only knew the layout of the ship by memory, but also knew its security protocols and codes. As the men and women assembled in the room, Masterson thought about what was coming. He had no illusions. But what had to be done, had to be done. That this crazy mission kept going forward, even in the face of obvious failure, suggested to him that the top officers weren't just affected by bad judgment, but may have actually been infected. Perhaps all of Mission Control, or the entire bridge. He looked around. Everyone appeared ready.
Okay, listen up.
Silence fell.
We're very fortunate to be joined by Mr. Ivan Vinter. He was, or rather still is, Deputy Chief of Security. I'm going to turn the floor over to him to describe the plan we've worked out.
Vinter, a massive man with a charismatic presence, stepped forward. The primary goal is to take the ship's bridge. The key element would be surprise. The secondary goal is to take over, or at least incapacitate, Mission Control. With those two objectives complete, we will proceed directly to Ushuaia. His tone was blunt and direct, and he spoke with a quiet, pleasing Scandinavian accent. The captain and officers will defend the bridge with a strong sense of duty. We may need to resort to violence, but no one on the bridge is likely to be armed. Only security is allowed to carry arms on the bridge, and there is no security there at the present time. A steely look around the room. No one flinched. The bridge is designed to stop entry by anyone who might try to commandeer the ship. There are only two points of ingress, port and starboard doors, quarter-inch steel. Under normal operations, those doors are left open. So we go in fast and hard, taking them by surprise, and seize control of the openings to prevent the doors from being shut and locked. Once we gain control of the bridge, then we turn the bridge's defenses to our own purpose by sealing the doors. Masterson stepped forward.
Thank you, Mr. Vinter. Any questions?
What about the engine room? Someone asked. Can't they shut down the engines from there? Yes, said Vinter. But once we're safely in control of the bridge, we can make our case via the ship's intercom, which we will also control, to the rest of the crew. They can conceivably shut down the engines and power, but that will only render the Batavia dead in the water. Not much use in that. And not a good means of persuasion. He paused, and then said with quiet and unshakable conviction, "We will have the upper hand. We will prevail." As Masterson looked out over the group, he saw that this man, with his rock-like presence and quiet voice, was having a galvanizing effect.
"We can't wait," he said. "Word will leak out. It always does. So we're doing this now. Are you all with us?"
Everyone was.
There are 20 of us. We're going to divide into 5 groups of 4. We'll head toward the bridge, strolling easily through the corridors, chatting lightly, attracting no attention. We'll converge at the lower bridge deck below the companionway, but there will be no pause. Just keep up the momentum, rush the doors, and secure them. Those with firearms, cover the officer of the watch, the captain, and the other bridge officers. If they resist, shoot, but only as a last resort. Those with knives, take up a defensive position at the doors.
Masterson paused. He realized he was sweating. He felt afraid, but when he glanced over at Vinter, standing beside him, he grew reassured. He wasn't afraid. The man exuded confidence.
What if the bridge doors are already locked? Someone asked.
They won't be, said Vinter. That's against all security protocols. But on the off chance they are, if there has been a recent worm attack, for example, then I will talk us in as Deputy Chief of Security. Masterson divided the people into groups and sent them off on different paths, all of which would converge at the bridge. He led one group. They took a somewhat roundabout route forward, trying to look nonchalant. As they moved through the ship, Masterson was struck by the atmosphere on board. While some people were still going about their business, much of the crew seemed idle, standing about in agitated groups.
Others were obviously inebriated, and one man lay in a corridor, empty bottle in hand, passed out. The withdrawal of security to sweep for worms, the lack of sleep, and the rampant suspicions among the crew about who might have been infected had caused a sharp deterioration in morale. It only reinforced Masterson's belief that they needed to get this ship into port as soon as possible. They could deal with the worm infestation once people were off the ship. Burn the vessel to the waterline. Scuttle it if necessary. Put everyone in quarantine until the infected could be identified. But decontaminating the ship wasn't his immediate problem. Right now, his problem was getting them the hell out of there. As he walked, he felt the bulge of the .45 Vinter had given him. Masterson wasn't a gun enthusiast, but he'd hunted with his father and knew how to aim and fire a pistol. He hoped to God he wouldn't have to use it. He led his group to the lower bridge deck, where the others were now converging. Without acknowledgement, they climbed the stairway to the bridge deck. The port bridge door was indeed open. Vinter was ahead of him, and he had his gun out. The man stepped easily through the door, Masterson following. Everyone on the bridge was so focused on their individual tasks that no one even looked in their direction. Masterson watched as Vinter raised his gun, casually aimed, and fired at the officer of the watch, hitting him in the back. The sound of the gun going off was incredibly loud, and the man went down as if he'd been hit with a sledgehammer. The cold-bloodedness of it froze Masterson. This wasn't what Vinter had said was going to happen. First, Officer Leonard, who was standing next to the officer of the watch and was, to Masterson's surprise, armed with a sidearm, spun, drew, and fired her own weapon with astonishing rapidity. Vinter was hit and thrown back against the wall. She fired again, the bullet whining just below Masterson's ear. She kept coming, kept firing. Masterson fell back through the door as a third round banged off the steel door jamb. Meanwhile, the rest of the bridge personnel were drawing weapons. They all had weapons, and were charging the mutineers, returning fire. Vinter, up against the inside wall of the bridge, fired his weapon a second time and dropped Leonard with a bullet that, all too obviously, took out her heart and its attendant plumbing. He fired again, hitting another officer, even as he himself took a second round. He staggered back through the door, bullets ricocheting around him, sparks flying. He took cover behind the door, and a moment later it was slammed shut. Masterson threw himself against it to force it back open, but it was too late. It was sealed. An alarm sounded on the ship's emergency system. "Son of a bitch!" Vinter roared, blood pouring from an ugly wound in his shoulder and another in his forearm. There was confusion among the mutineers behind them. A shot was fired in the companionway, then another. "We're under attack from behind!" someone yelled. Vinter swung around and, still bleeding, charged down the stairs, gun still in hand. The others followed. Several security officers, converging on the scene, began shooting and took down a couple of mutineers, but were themselves quickly cut down by Vinter and some of the others. "Retreat to staff quarters!" Vinter shouted. "To quarters!" They raced along the main deck, people scattering as they charged past. There was very little additional security to be seen. Vinter plunged down the companionway to the staff quarters. As they poured through, he slammed and dogged the door. "Seal the doors and back!" he cried. "We can defend this space!" The doors were sealed. Vinter leaned against the wall, his hand pressed on the gunshot wound in his shoulder.
"We've got to get you help," said Masterson.
The man gave an ugly laugh.
"Get me some bandages and compresses, and I'll be fine."
There was bewilderment and confusion among the mutineers who had managed to get back.
"What the hell happened?" asked one.
"They were armed," Vinter said. "The presence of the worms must have changed the no-arms protocol. My fault."
He sagged down into a chair as the rest gathered around.
"We can hold out here. We've got food and water. And arms. It'll be hell for them to root us out. It would take cutting torches or explosives to get through those doors, and we'll be keeping a watch to nip any of that in the bud. Besides, they have other things on their minds."
But
Masterson felt overwhelmed with confusion.
What do we do now?
Stick to the plan. Take the bridge. There's some C4 in the security armory. We'll blow those doors. And I can hack our way into the shipwide intercom, rally others to the cause. He took a few breaths.
We've had a setback. But we can still do this. Discipline on the ship is falling apart. That's to our advantage.
Pounding began on the door to staff quarters, followed by shouting. Vinter rose, made a gesture to Masterson.
Talk to them. Tell them we want to take the ship to safety, to Ushuaia. Get them to join us, if only to save their own lives.
Chapter 61 Garza gazed at the video image on his iPad, coming from the camera that had been lowered 40 feet through the vertical engine air duct.
Oh, Jesus. That's the mother of all breeders, he said, passing the iPad to Moncton.
Moncton gave a low whistle.
I'm not surprised. That's just where the flue makes a 90-degree turn from vertical to horizontal. It's flat, protected, and particularly warm from the engine.
He passed the iPad back.
I suggest we go in from the side. Maybe we don't even need to cut a hole.
But that means going back through the engine room and into the alcove holding the compressor and turbocharger. Garza turned to the two remaining men on his team.
What do you say?
Let's do it. Once again, they descended into the bowels of the ship, Moncton leading the way. Garza was mightily impressed with Moncton. He was a rather odd fellow, with a curiously precise way of walking, almost like a dancing master, small and neat, but damn near unflappable. Garza could hardly believe how tough the guy was. Over the past hour, Garza had started to feel they might actually be able to overcome the worms after all. While the things were still everywhere, they had killed 3 giant breeding masses and zapped countless loose worms, and that seemed to have put the fear of God into the things. They seemed less aggressive and more prone to run and hide than attack en masse. He hadn't been able to raise the security chief, Betances, on the radio since their last communication 20 minutes before. He hoped to God that didn't mean what he feared it meant. A short trip brought them to the closed door of the engine room. While the ship was not underway, the engines were still throbbing gently, the main engine keeping the ship in position using dynamic positioning, and the synchronized generators supplying electric power. Garza felt a twinge as they gathered at the steel hatch into the engine room. After their first encounter, Moncton had jerry-rigged a heavy-duty zapper on a long pole, which they had plunged into the jelly-like breeding mass. It had worked well. Electricity was deadly to the worms, and it didn't take much of it to kill them.
I'll go first, said Moncton.
Garza stood to one side, his 2 team members behind. They lowered their face shields and tugged on heavy gloves, poor protection though they were. Garza eased the hatch open. Moncton stepped inside, zapper at the ready, and he followed. It was hot and close. Bits and pieces of smashed worms lay about.
The bodies are gone, said one of his men.
Yeah, they sleep 2 hours, then wake up and act normal. They're probably walking around the ship as we speak.
Right, right. Maybe we should have...
The man hesitated.
Put them out of their misery, said Garza. Maybe.
The men fell silent. The engine room seemed normal, aside from the dead worms on the floor. The vent dangled open, and a dark liquid was dripping from it and streaking part of the main engine. The liquid, Garza realized, was draining from the breeding mass they had killed farther up the vent.
The air supply, along with the turbo and compressor, is in the back, Moncton said.
Garza and the other 2 followed the ship's chief engineer down the main aisle of the engine room. The room was brightly lit, and there was no additional sign of worms. Moncton reached the end of the giant main engine, ducked under a pipe, turned a tight corner, then stopped. There, in front of them, was a large galvanized flue, which came down through the ceiling and made a 90-degree turn. It yawned open in a huge, mouth-like vent, 6 feet tall, looming over a mass of pipes and tubes. The compressor, turbo, and aftercooler. It lay behind a forest of pipes and valves. Moncton whispered,
The mass is right inside and below the elbow. I think we ought to try zapping it right through the galvanized flue.
Won't there be a Faraday cage effect, the charge dissipated?
No, because the mass itself is a better conductor than the steel. The majority of the charge will go right into it.
There's only enough room for one person to squeeze in there, Garza told him.
I'll go. Monckton shook his head. No. My turn.
Garza wasn't about to argue. He gestured for his two to stay back, their zappers ready. He followed Monckton into the tight space as far as he could.
Get ready to run, Monckton whispered into his ear as he crouched,
zapper pole in hand, working his way still farther into the jungle of colored pipes. Garza began to lose sight of the man in the knitted shadows. He waited. At any moment, he would hear the crackle of the zapper as Monckton shot the side of the steel duct, along with the high-pitched screams of the worms inside as they were electrocuted. Instead, he heard a rustling, whispering, scritching noise from behind, followed by the sounds of things hitting the ground. He turned. Both of his men were down, down without a sound, their heads covered with writhing worms, their arms waving feebly before flopping to the ground.
Monckton, he cried. Get back! We've been ambushed!
But there was no sound from ahead, except more rustlings and whisperings. And now he saw it. Worms were gliding everywhere through the pipes, coming for him. Garza jammed his zapper on a metal pipe and pulled the trigger. A sudden chorus of squealing arose as the worms jumped and jerked, falling off the pipe. He plunged backward, hitting several more pipes, zapping worm after worm, slapping and pulling them off him as they rained down from above. He was yelling at the top of his lungs, tearing off his shirt as the worms got inside. He leapt over the worm-infested bodies of the two men, and then, feeling the worms all over his body, he turned the zapper on himself, jabbing it into his chest and pulling the trigger in desperation. It was like being hit by a truck. An immense jolt and flash of light, and he lost the use of his legs and fell to the ground. But even as he crashed to the floor, barely conscious, he realized the worms had dropped from his body. Crawling, trembling all over, he zapped himself again. Then he collapsed. He wasn't unconscious, merely unable to use his muscles. He felt like an immense stone was on his chest, retarding his breathing. But the worms were crawling away, fleeing him. He lay there, trying to breathe, trying to clear his head of the millions of stars. After a moment, with an immense act of will, he managed to pull himself to his knees and crawl the length of the engine room, get to the door, climb over the metal lip, and seal it behind him. Then he fell back on the cold steel decking and tried to get his jumping, tingling muscles back under control. It was in that moment he realized they had failed. They were never going to clear the ship of worms. Because the worms were adapting.
Chapter 62. Thank God, thought Gideon, that the nuke chamber was high security and damn near impregnable. Glynn's QBA had proven correct. The ship had descended into chaos. They had just received word that a group of mutineers had tried to take over the bridge, killed Leonard and the officer of the watch, and were now holed up in the crew quarters. They had somehow taken over the ship's intercom and were broadcasting their message, steadily attracting converts to the cause. A group of people had tried to steal the ship's helicopter and even managed to get it aloft, but the A-Star had only gone a quarter of a mile before spinning out of control and crashing into the sea. There were also reports that the DSV John had been stolen and launched by persons unknown. The ship was overrun with worms. Garza had just reported the loss of his remaining team and the ship's chief engineer to a worm attack. The people attacked by the worms, Gideon knew, were not dead, of course. They were going about their business as if normal, but all the while unconsciously doing the bidding of that thing down at the bottom of the ocean. And doing so while remaining resolutely certain their actions were justified and logical, even while they were carrying out sabotage and murder. Inside the nuke chamber, Glynn and McFarlane, with the aid of two technicians, had used a ceiling track winch to lift the nuke onto an electric dolly, specially built to transport it to the hangar deck for loading onto the ROV. All the electronics had checked out. Gideon had given the device a final once-over. The bomb was going to work perfectly. All that remained to do was set the timer. Now the nuke was in a canvas sling dangling from the ceiling track lift. Slowly, slowly, the two technicians lowered the device onto the cradle built to receive it, steadying it in gloved hands, and rotating it into position. Done. The technicians unhooked the winch cables. Glynn went to the door and listened. Gideon could hear periodic muffled noises in the hall outside. Glynn went into the back of the nuke chamber, unlocked a cabinet. Gideon was startled to see that it contained a small arsenal of firearms. Glynn sorted through them and removed 5 Colt 45 pistols in holsters, a stack of magazines, and boxes of bullets. He placed them on a work table. "We may need to defend ourselves," he said. "Each one of you take a sidearm and load 2 magazines." McFarlane quickly sorted through the weapons, Gideon following. The two technicians hesitated. "Ever fire a weapon before?" Glynn asked them. One shook his head and the other said, "I'm not sure now's the time to start." Glynn leaned in. "This is no time for scruples." He pulled a pistol from the holster, ejected the magazine, demonstrated how to insert rounds into it, slapped it back into place, and showed them how the safety worked, and how to rack the initial round into the chamber. "Both hands on the grip when you fire. Understood?" He handed a gun to each technician. "It's a war zone out there. We need to do what it takes to get this device up to the hangar deck." Gideon discarded the holster and stuck a gun into his belt. Glynn turned to the nuke sitting in the cradle. "And now we'd better disguise that." He opened a life preserver container, ubiquitous throughout the ship, pulled out a few preservers, and heaped them up on the nuke. "Cover it with a tarp." The technicians placed the tarp over and tied it down with straps, creating a vague, canvas-covered lump. "What's it supposed to be?" asked Gideon. "Chalks and dunnage," said Glynn. "What the hell's that?" "No one's going to ask. Let's go. 2 in front, 2 behind, guns drawn and visible. Sam, you watch our rear." Glynn unlocked the door while one technician climbed into the seat of the motorized dolly. The nuke chamber was deep in the ship. They had to take it half the ship's length and up 3 decks in order to reach the hangar. Glynn swung open the door. The corridor was empty. They reached the elevator without incident, not running into anyone and not seeing any worms. The elevator doors shut, and Glynn pressed the button for the hangar deck. Even before the doors opened, Gideon could hear shouting. He drew his weapon, and so did the rest. The elevator door slid open to reveal a group of men waiting for the elevator. They, too, all had weapons. The main armory had apparently been looted, and they looked agitated.
"Hey.